23827, Reel 6.
John Street, Reel 6. So where were you on VE Day?
Well, I was flying, funnily enough, from Pomigliano, which is just outside of Naples. In fact, we were on an ASR op. I think we'd been sent down to. I was flying back actually. We were flying from Malta to Pomigliano after a detachment. We'd been down there. Again, we'd been sent down to get an aircraft. On May the 29th, I crashed in an aircraft, and in June, because we had no aircraft, we had to get in and fetch one. So we went down to Malta, flew down, the Americans flew us down to Malta, and we brought our aircraft back. And that was the day that peace was declared, June.
How did you hear the news?
We didn't hear it until we landed, and there wasn't anybody about. And then we saw this drunken airman, and I got real annoyed. I put my big hat on and charge him. And he told me a thing or two. I think he thought he'd left the air. I think he thought his service in the Air Force had finished. And eventually we went back to the... I went to the mess, because... we had a met, actually met, we were living in proper buildings in Pomigliano. The workers' buildings, they were lovely buildings. I lived in the officers' one, and my crew lived in the... So I went in, and of course they were all, the officers were there, and they had... Bucks Fizz. No, not Bucks Fizz. Well, they got... the champagne in Guinness.
Oh, right, yes. Black Velvet.
Black Velvet. Well, we had our own version, Mary Down Cider and Stout. And that was going, and I could say, what's going on? I think we knew in the back of our mind that peace was there. Because when we were listening to the news in Malta, that they were, the overtures were being made, and they said it's signed, you know, we're in peace.
Yeah. And what was your feeling then?
I was glad the war was over. I thought there was better things in life than having a war. I could still enjoy. If I stayed in the Air Force, I could still enjoy. And we flew a few times after that, up until July, the end of July, or the beginning of July. And now I was beginning to get worried, I think, because people were being posted. And of course, there were so many air crew. There were thousands of us, all with nothing to do, basically. And they were ending up in stores, and you heard these awful tales from the NCOs, especially, that were having to cover their badges of rank up during the day and work on menial jobs. Of course, everybody was scrambling. Any more flying jobs? Any more flying? There weren't any. And suddenly, out of the bat, they did. My CO, he said, John, he said, you want to carry on flying, don't you? And I said, yeah, I don't want to carry on flying. I'm not going to do anything else. So, I mean, I wasn't an admin officer or an engineering officer or anything. He said, right, he said, there's a posting. And I said, where is that? He said, in Latoria. I said, well, where the hell's that? Where's Latoria? Littoria. He said, it's outside Rome. Well, I said, how the hell am I going to get up there? You know, the usual silly thing you do. But he said, you actually got to go to Pisa. That's where you got to go. That's where the headquarters is. So I said, oh, fair enough. So then I got on the SAF transport, South African Air Force transport, and he landed me up at Pisa, P-I-S-A. And I joined the squadron, and lo and behold, it was walruses.
Oh, right. Which which squadron was this?
This was 624 Squadron. Now, the Walrus was out of date before I was born. No, not quite as old as that. It was an amphibious boat, three-seater. Did about 40 miles an hour, two wings, and had a pusher prop on it. Which you started like a car, not like you start a car, like I used to start a car when I was a boy, winding the handle. It had a gun position in the front, which was ran by anybody who was spare. And the navigator used to navigate with his thing on his lap. And of course, again, it was really all I bore. And I thought, oh, God almighty, you know, and I thought, air sea rescue again. Obviously, that's what the Walrus was used for. Then, no, we were hunting mines. And I thought this was a tell. Until the CO actually told me, I thought, how do you look for mines? But it appears that these mines, when you look at them out of a calm sea, they're like a little green pea. Well, like a green ball. And the Germans were so particular, efficient, that they left maps showing where these mines were. But not exactly where they were. So we had to go out and find them. And we used to find these maps. They were laid in lines like that in a minefield around the various harbours. Around Naples, we used to see. But then we were sent down basically to kind of fly low over these harbours to make sure there weren't any spare ones down there.
You could see them.
And you called the Navy in, and we were actually now, instead of being with America, this was the Navy. And again, it was a Walrus over mine, but it was a fantastic job. I mean, all the pilots were pretty good pilots. That's why they got sent there, because they were kind of keeping the pop good. And I think, to be quite honest, the navigators were good. Yeah. Because if you found a mine, I mean, it's only a little, it's not much bigger than a... Well, you know what a mine is. I don't know. What big is that? It was about 6 foot high. But we used to be able to tell the Navy practically within yards where it was. Because you could get these aircraft, they go very slow. And of course, they were all around. And you had so many. There were many ways of finding out where you were. I mean, mainly eyeballs, of course. But you had to be good at it. You had to be good at it. And. I think you had to be a good navigator, and I think that's why I got sent there, you know. And I'm not being begetted about this. I think I was a good navigator. Well, we did, I did that from August the 11th. And I did quite a lot of flying these things. Mainly from Littoria, from Pisa, and then down to Littoria, which was this film just outside Rome. Now, they were starting to look around that they... As typical, perhaps, of the Air Force, they started to get rid of people, and they realised they never had enough people. And so I was made EVT officer. That was my secondary duty, education and vocational training officer. And this is where I got involved with the psychiatrists and things from. When I was a squadron member, I lived in the mess, again, in tents. And I must admit that most of these pilots were ex-fighter boys. And in fact, most of them have been in trouble, you know, doing a victory roll over the Vatican, you know, at 10 feet, scaring the Pope to death, and he'd get posted there. They won't court-martial him. Send him down to the war resist. That'll teach him a lesson. Spitfire to war resist. But they enjoyed it like we did. We just had lots of fun. If you can substitute a bit from what I'm going to tell you, we used to see how far you could go out to sea, land, throw a bit of litter over, take a photograph of you throwing a bit of litter over, and then come back in a competition to see. Well, you can imagine. We used to fix this camera lab, and two of us stood on the wing doing something unmentionable. And, you know, things like that. It was so silly, but we're doing a good job, I suppose. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I must admit, I got great fun out of flying. I did enjoy it.
Yeah. What about this EVT officer role?
Oh, EVT. It was supposed to be educationally and vocational training. of the airmen that were now spare, because a lot of them are more spare airmen around, spare officers, I suppose. And I had a team. I had a flight lieutenant who'd just come out from England. I think he'd only just joined up. He was an educator. He was a school teacher, and he did the English writing, composition, reading. And I had a Greek, a Palestinian, but he was not at Harrow, he was the other side. He was a Jewish side, I suppose. Of course, Israel wasn't there yet, that had to come. Yeah. But I should imagine he was not a Palestinian. He was not an Arab. He was whatever the other one was, and he was my maths teacher. He used to teach maths in Lena, and I used to do the vocational training. And again, this was lovely because I got to meet a lot of ladies, and these ladies were all English ladies, and they were the equivalent of the men that you had before the war, the remittance men. You had a man who didn't fit in with a high life of his. He was just made a fool of himself with perhaps the serving girl. He was sent overseas. He used to live on his postal orders that he used to get from his dad. There were women that were like that.
In Italy.
And a lot of them lived in Naples, Rome. And a lot of them have been there all through the war. And they were lovely, some of them. And they were all sculptors and painters and authors. And I used to get these, and I used to pay them with tea, £1/4 of tea.
And what would they teach?
They used to give an appreciation of art. And there were quite famous ones, actually. I didn't know this till years afterwards. My wife actually done a little bit of research on it. To find out who, because I had a lot of, I don't know where they all are, they've all vanished. I had like postcards, the biggest postcards, and they were signed, and they've been quite famous women, some of them, and I didn't know this at the time. So I didn't know my wife at the time, so it was that before I met my wife, but afterwards.
So how did this art appreciation go down with the men?
Some of them liked it, it all is. Some of them found it got a new interest in life. I mean, I had one fella. I don't think he could hardly spell his own name. He was a rough, real rough diamond. And I took him to Bellini, the Bellini Museum, and it's a beautiful museum. And it's where that statue of one of the Bonaparte women is reclining on a couch with an apple, and of course she's semi-nude. And I was watching this fella, and he was up there, and he was poking it. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "It's hard." He said, "It looks soft." He said, "He almost felt as though I wanted to touch it. I had to touch it." He said, and I was so interested in this, and every time he'd say to me, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to some church today." And I don't think you've been in a church before. We go up to these churches. Not the ones, some of them should have been on the tourist map. But there's one church there that's, it's got no, all the only ornaments got is wooden ornaments, but they're all godly. So they're worth a fortune. You know, and some of the priests were quite interested in talking about their church. I suppose they've been there all their life and never spoke to anybody about their church.
So you got quite interested in art.
I got
as
it
well.
Myself, yeah. And what I really got interested in was this, the classical music. Because I had a pass to both the big operas in the Rome Opera House, but more so in the Baths, which was the open air opera, because I was. I was not property master, I wasn't casting master, I had a name, I had a title, because they'd ring me up and they'd say, Capitano, they used to call it, Capitano Street. We want 400 men, they're doing Aida. And this bars, the audience was here and the stage was there, and there was nothing there, And you used to get these men, and I'd be there with walkie-talkies they had in those days, getting them, mustering them as they marched down. And they marched down, what they did, they marched down carrying torches. And they'd leave the torches, and they'd march. As they got nearer, they'd pick up tigers, trained, and dogs. Proper tigers, yeah.
Real tigers.
And I remember they had a black panther there, but they got from the zoo, I suppose. And they would, walk down dressed as a... Sorry, I forgot. They would walk down dressed as a... Well, Egyptian, isn't it?
Yeah.
I did very well there.
Yeah. And were they in costume?
Hmm? Oh, in costume, yeah. They used to dress them up.
Yeah.
And I met...
What did they think of that?
They enjoyed it, most of them. They got paid. Oh. You know, there's only one book a few bottles of wine. I met... Judith's sister, which years later I was at Blackpool and she was up there and I went and knocked at her stage door and she remembered me and I thought, oh, that was marvellous. At least she remembered me.
Yeah. And she sang, did she?
She sang in the, yeah, and I saw Geely. And I never spoke, I was in his company, I never spoke to him there. Mm. Geely.
What was he like to see him sing?
Big fat tenor, but he was a nice singer. Nice man. They were all nice. He couldn't speak very much English, I don't think. She spoke the English. I couldn't speak Italian. Never could. And even things like circus was an art form, perhaps more over there. And I met dancers, these girls who... But they had a special name. They twist their body in all sorts of different shapes inside. Acrobatic dancers and ballet dancers I met. And I didn't get caught on the ballet. I didn't like that very much, but I liked opera. Mm. I love opera.
Did you see lots of operas in Rome? Did you see a lot of operas?
I never missed anything. If I was there in opera, I went. Because I say I got myself inside, and I left and went back there. I spent my honeymoon there, and I managed to get to see the opera there. And I'd been away for I managed to get in there. And
so where did you meet your wife?
Well, during this EVT was in Rome, and then the bottom fell out of that, and they said, well, you know, we're going to start posting people. And he said to me, do you want to hang on to the end, John? And I said, no, I think I want to go into the Air Force, stay in the Air Force. I think I ought to get myself known in the non-flying side. And rather funny, he agreed with me, and he sent me down to Malta on an officer's course, an admin officer's course, that was held in a place... It was one of the mortal airfields, Califran, I think. I mean, I don't know how to spell that, which was the old seaplane base. Mm-hmm. And we were taught to be officers and administrators. And I came back from there in, it must have been November 1945. And I got myself a job... in the AHQ, Caserta, which is one of the royal palaces, and my job took me out to the outstations, and I used to go to Naples a lot. And every time I went to Naples, this young girl would be more or less, she would be my contact, and when I wanted something in the office, and she could type, she could copy type. And what she had a lot of letters written in Italian and the English version. And if you said to her, well, I want to write a letter to the MU up in Udine demanding something, she'd flick through her book and find a letter and copy it out. She's quite quick, but she typed in English, but she thought Italian. And I then I had to do an inquiry into something that was happening. And I found out she went to this place. I suppose basically, I'm not being well, I suppose I am actually. I was an officer, and she would be a perhaps an airman's rank, if there was any rank in it, but she was a civilian. So she could go to this place where I had to do this inquiry. So I managed to get her to take me there, and I sorted this inquiry, I sorted this business out, and but I'd more or less taken her out, if you know what I mean, and I think the family accepted me, and eventually we got married.
Yeah. Before you left Italy then?
No, I was still in Italy, and I thought I was going to be there forever. I seemed to dig myself in wherever I went, and I was equivalent of the town marshal in Naples. I had quite a high position there for a flight lieutenant. Well, I was a high position because all the others had gone. And
what were your duties there then?
Well, I was the adjutant of adjutant of the base area, but I was responsible for the non-public funds in the rest and leave camps at down the road, down by that island where Gracie Fields lived, down by Capri, Sorrento. Mm-hmm. I was responsible for the three hotels in Sorrento for their non-public money. I was responsible for the non-public money in the marine craft brace. It was on the far corner of Ischia. I had a couple of MUs. One in the Vesuvius region. Mm-hmm. And I did have some in, but not a lot in, because Transport Command was actually running the airport. But I was responsible for the... I had a Malkin Club, which was the club I did the inquiry on. I had the closing down of the NAFI. It was in the Caserta Royal Palace. I didn't. That was a long job, so I never finished that. I had to hand it over to someone else to finish. And I got around quite a bit, and I learned quite a lot. And I had two COs, two officers, two group captains, both who were very good to me and taught me a lot. And then when I closed that down, they posted me then to Udine, and I ran. I was the adjutant of the staging post at Udine. Mm-hmm. And I was very lucky here because the CO was been tasked by the Air Ministry to involve himself in the possibility of aircraft landing on skis. And he was sent there because it was not a very busy place for a group captain. So I more or less ran that station on my own. So I got my flight lieutenant. So I was one of the few people that got promoted after the war.
Yeah.
But I wasn't for very long because I, unfortunately, my luck gave out. I applied for a permanent commission in the RAF. I came back to England. The three of us came back to England. And my interview in there lasted about 3 minutes. And I was accused of being something by the officer, a young squadron leader. And he said to me, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I would like to stay flying. I understand Transport Command is being built up." He said, "Well, I don't think you could fly in a modern airplane." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Well," he said, "you learn in answers." And I said, "Do you know anything about flying?" He said, "Well, that's a silly question. I'm a squadron leader pilot." And I said, "I'll ask you again. Do you know anything about flying?" I said, "Or do you know anything about the back end?" I said, "Because a navigator works in 6 minutes cycles. And if he does 30 miles between those 6 minutes, he's doing 300 miles an hour." I said, "If he does 60 miles an hour, he's doing 600 miles an hour. He's working, not working any faster or any slower." And I said, I would say now, my last aircraft went 40 miles an hour. I said, we have meteors with them. But I said, you put me in the back of a meteor. I said, I will fly that meteor. I would navigate that meteor with eyeballs, I said, eyeball navigation, from near Malta. No, Rome, I think it was. Can't remember whether it was when I came back to England, but I tangled with this bloke and he got a bit snotty about it. And then they suggested that it might be a good thing for me to go out to the Far East, but I couldn't take my wife with me, so I took my discharge.
Right, you got married by then.
I'd been married then about a year, I should say.
So you were discharged when?
So I actually got back here in April 1947.
Right. So what were your feelings on having left the RAF then?
What were them?
What were your feelings?
I was very upset.
Yeah.
I thought there was a vocation there that I could have been a good RAF officer. Mm. And I'd had a foot start because I was now a flight lieutenant. I mean, my next step would be a field rank, a squadron leader. Mm. And I felt that I had a lot to offer the Air Force because I thought I was a good navigator. Rather unfortunately, this tanglement with this fellow obviously didn't do me any good. And later on, I found this business of pilot and navigators. A pilot should never be asked to sit on boards where a navigator are, because pilots know nothing about navigation whatsoever. I was still doing my job, as I say. After I'd been refused a permanent commission, I was still doing my job, but every now and again I was off up to an HQ where I had a friend and I was diving through his posting files, and I found this posting to a comm flight, and I think it was a comm flight that was, I think the comm flight was in, could have been in Palestine or somewhere, I can't remember now, but there was possibilities it was going out to India. And I made a few checkups. There were Indian wives were now being allowed to go to India. And I applied for this posting, and I went up there, and a pilot, and he said to me, oh, yes, he said, what do you know about G? And I said, what do I know about G, I said, a navigational aid. Have you ever used it? I trained on it. Have you ever used it? No, he said, I've always been stationed in the Mediterranean. So he looked at me for a while and he said, oh, well, you never actually used it. He said, well, I want a man that's got... I said, what do you want a man that's got G for? He said, because there's G out there. I said, there's no G out there. G's in England. I said, it's not a navigational aid. I said, it's basically a bombing aid. I said, the South of France is as far as you can go before. I said, you run out of South of France, you ran out of G, I said. And he told me I was a fool. And I got very cross about this because I went, by now, of course, I was getting to know people. They were somebody. And there was a man I knew who was a group captain. And I met him socially and I said to him, that fella you got there, I said, and I told him the story, and the bloke was posted back to England, so I didn't make any friends.
Yeah.
And then I said, when this business came up, that I'd have to perhaps go to China or to Japan, I think Japan, and I didn't want to leave my wife in Italy, and I didn't want to leave her in England on her own, so I took my discharge, and I came back and became a civilian.
John Street, end of Reel 6.